in L2, what is it that you're subsidizing? So I think that the system in the past was that if somebody had 20 buses, that then that person was entitled to so much money, irrespective. But I think that we should move to a situation, that's why I'm saying that, Chairperson, I don't think that this one is a final, what you call it, it's a solution. It's not necessarily a solution. But I think that we need to move towards a situation where the subsidy is clear, that does it subsidize the bus operation or does it subsidize the person that you want to be in that bus? And if then we're subsidizing the people that are using the buses, that means that we must develop systems to ensure that if the bus says, if the bus driver in his logbook or her logbook says that the bus was overloaded, who else can, what you call it, confirm that the bus was overloaded or what? In other words, I think that the debate, I don't think that this is the end of the debate. I think that a lot of thought needs to go into this in order to find a solution.
For that, Sokon, I do want us to firstly to just deal with this 0506. So I'm just saying, finance, if there is some overdraft, if you like, how are we handling that? If there is some overdraft, do we have plans? Do we know what amount are we talking about? And how are we going to deal with that? So that if we've dealt with that, then going forward to the implementing the new plan, it's not a big deal. But for me, that's where we need to start. If there was some overspending there, if you like, how are we dealing with it, Mr. Brown?
Thanks. What I would propose, Honorable Chair, because I am only coming into the fold because this thing is now conditional grant and my responsibility relates to that. I'm just worried I may mislead this particular committee if I talk from limited information on this matter. I mean, if I take your question now, it's something that I will then take to the Treasury and say there's this particular question that has been asked. How do we then respond to this particular question? We can do it in writing. But the department can also assist us in terms of the information that they have at this juncture to say, look here, ever since that, this is the kind of deterioration that we've seen. This has been the impact over a period of time and all of that. And how do we then use this so that we stabilize the system and moving forward? I'm just worried I may tell lies here. Okay.
Honorable Chairperson, thank you. If I might just try and respond to that. We were called by our portfolio committee of transport to come and deal with this matter. So for the benefit of this committee, we would maybe rely on the parliamentary system and we can assist as the Department of Transport and make available to you a comprehensive presentation we made to portfolio committee 5 weeks ago, towards the end of January. Comprehensive, Chair. It will tell you what we asked for in 2005 as part of the MTF allocation and what we're given. What we then, as an emergency measure, went to ask for at adjustment estimate 2005-2006. And what we were given. And you will see very clearly how that deficit develops. Not in 2005-06. In 2005-06, 2006-07, 2007-08, 2008-09. Every single year, this program has been consistently underfunded. And we'll show you that. Figures are there, they're factual, they're on record. They are part of our MTF allocations. As we submit them, they are part of our adjustment estimate, treasury submissions, the information is there. So that we can answer those questions and indicate to you precisely what then happened on the allocation side, the expenditure side, and we show you the shortfall every year. And we say because of the shortfall of X in that year, this was the shortfall. We carried it over to the next year. This was the shortfall in the following year. We carried it over to the next year. And you'll see where we were in January with the deficit that was part of the subject of the court deliberation. Now, the immediate implications of issues like this is, first, when you have a deterioration in service levels, our people get packed like sardines in those buses, simply because we're unable to respond to the increased demand. Bus operators cut corners. They start not servicing the buses. The quality of the bus starts deteriorating, simply because, even for them, the sums don't add up because the subsidy money is not coming through. Cutting corners, Chair, in relation to the tendering arrangements we have with them. As I indicated earlier, there are three contracts. There's a tender contract, which is possibly, if I want to respond to what the other honorable member raised, the safest contract that exists is tendered contract. The second type, which is negotiated, still allows room, which is kilometer-based negotiation, still allows room for some form of negotiation and arrangements which are a little bit more flexible. But the interim contracts are probably the most problematic because they are driven by ticket sales. Now, by definition, driving these things by ticket sales is being more aligned to subsidizing the person rather than the operator. The challenge with that is means of verification, monitoring, and in fact we've had no less than two cases in Mpumalanga. It's the administrative implications of running interim contracts are 10 times what you need for a tendered contract. But we've had cases in Mpumalanga where clearly we've had to terminate contracts on those arrangements because of the corruption that ensues in an interim contract arrangement. So they're highly risky. They're more effective sometimes, but if you can't count, and we have systems where we do reconciliations, the bus company submits and says, I've carried X number of people, you have a mechanism of going to do spot tests and assess whether that's true or not. It's not accurate, but it's the best you can do after the event, after the tickets have been sold. So I think the reality is that what we've seen as a decline in bus services in these areas have come as a result of the underfunding of this particular area. We think the only thing that DORA does for us is to create a rigid framework. Firstly, to ensure that there's certainty about the allocated money backed by tendered contracts preferably, but allowing some little room for negotiated contracts. Because the real fluid situation means you can't fix everything on tender. There's going to be 5-10% that you need to manage differently. But secondly, that under those arrangements you would have firm understanding by provincial heads of departments around what level of service they are allowed to provide. So what does DORA do? It helps us to put a cage around this bus subsidy thing. That's what it does. But let me be honest with you. DORA does not give us a solution to providing bus services for all our people who need them out there. Because through that cage, we'll crawl and creep all this excess number of people that we can't cope with. But if that's the approach Treasury is adopting to say, let's define a rigid framework, then we'll start increasing your allocations into the future because we trust this rigid framework has sufficient controls and limits leakages from the system. But that must be backed up very quickly with increases in allocations. Because to just put a cage over it does not solve the problem. Because the problem we have from our mandate, from our responsibility, is that there are more people than there are buses, and there are more people who want to jump on buses. Simple equation. So whether you give the money through DORA or give the money through other means, it doesn't reduce the number of people that are waiting at a bus stop. Those people don't reduce. Those queues don't go down just because we've changed the legislative arrangements and the mechanism for making those payments. It means the risk maybe that National Treasury perceived with the old arrangements reduces and therefore allows them the ability to increase those allocations so they start matching demand. Now there's another constitutional issue which we must bring to bear. What is really our commitment as South Africa in relation to the provision of public transport? Are we at a point where we can say we shall provide for every person who requires public transport a mechanism for commuting? Because if we can, that's fine, then we'll provide 100%. But the reality is that with population growth in South Africa, the amount that we provide for subsidies, even if it were to increase, would never meet all of the requirements. So the reality is we'll always provide for some, and we'll go for the poorest in that category. But the reality is the combination of these subsidized buses, plus the other initiatives we'll bring through PTIF and all the other funds, will one day get us to a point at which we can say, largely, our people are able to access public transport and get to work with a combination of the subsidized ones and the BRTs and the municipal ones and the taxi industry and everything else will get us to a position where we can say safely 70% of our population, when they need public transport, they get it. But the reality is, one, there is no constitutional definition of what that percentage should be. It's largely driven by affordability. So when we can afford, we'll do 70%. When we can't afford, Treasury will say to us, sorry, there's no money, and they'll give us, we'll cover for 50%. The challenge as a country we must be able to answer is, what do we do with the queues at the bus stop? That's the challenge. Thank you, sir.
You know, the challenge finally for the country is the buggies that you see in the rural areas that are also overflowing, and then some of the men and women never reach home alive. Proceed, Mr. Brown.
No, thanks, Honorable Chair. Thanks, DJ. I think the DJ has got it, the nail on its head there. The problem that you are faced with, in an environment of limited resources, how do you proceed? Because if you have the Department of Housing here, the Department of Housing will tell you that our backlog for housing is in the order of about 120 billion rand. In some cases, they even exaggerated with municipal infrastructure grant to over 200 billion rand. Then you start to say, look here, how do you balance this? Do you provide for settlements so that people they have at least a roof on top of their head, or do you do this? So there is this issue around reprioritization. I don't think if we continue with the discussion here, it will help us. But the big point, Honorable Chair, that we need to bring forward here is how our urban settlements develop. There's a linkage between the two. There is a linkage between the two. We're talking differentiated approach of municipalities precisely because of the problem that we have. Because if our settlements are continue to grow in the manner in which that they are growing, we will continue to have the request from the DG coming, I want more money because the settlements are too far from areas of work. So government must think, within this environment of limited resources, how do I efficiently structure my human settlements in such a way that I start to minimize costs for that matter, right? So that is what's coming in. And I don't think we should be too harsh on each other here, because if one looks at all of the grants that start to flow into public transport now, they are really growing quite significantly, and they are, right? So we are moving in the direction, but the debate must be raised at the way the DJ has actually raised it, to say now, let's talk that proper integration that we want in terms of that. Because it comes back to the parachuting that you are talking about. And if you look at, for example, now even here, we're only talking urban. Urban. You must now ask the question to us, what about the rural areas? Where do they fit in within this entire strategy? What one hopes is, when we start to deliberate and finalize, deal with the financing of will see. I mean, the DG indicated in her presentation there that once the PTIS and the 2010 issues are sorted out, a lot of the money will start to also move into a particular direction. And I think even in our deliberation about the rural transport issues that you have raised, Mr. Sogoni, at some point these things will meet. We're talking 5 or 6 municipalities now and 5 programs there. But ultimately, what you need in each and every municipality to have that kind of rural kind of strategy to be able to deal with this thing. Now, within an environment of limited resources, Honorable Chair, government must give direction as to how efficiently we need to use those particular resources. I mean, you are starting now. At least today you are catering for us after 3 or 4 days without catering. No, it sounds ridiculous, but it is a fact. You know, I was telling when they said in these hearings, for the part time that we were in the department that we've seen here, I've counted. We had about 50 representatives from departments. And mark my word, if you counted how many people spoke, the DGs and 1 or 2 people, if 10 of them spoke, then you ask yourself, but 30, 40 people came here. How much did it cost us to bring the people to this particular meeting? If we just started to rationalize that, we could have made a difference already. So it is the efficiency that we will have to talk about. And I think the current economic conditions are starting to force us to talk about those particular efficiencies. Thank you.
I'm saying let's resolve that thing then, DG and some people at National Treasury. Okay? And let's just start there and then do all the other things so that the incoming committee of finance and the portfolio committee that are coming must then deal with this comprehensive report you're talking about. Then all the other things, because you see the problem is that the gap would always remain. And until we've dealt with that deficit, I mean, it's just waste. I mean, in the context, again, you are right, but there are departments that continuously underspend. Housing is one of those, we know. Earlier, we're talking to 2 departments that are underspending. So those are some of the things we might be looking at. But I'm just saying that one really needs to be resolved because we don't know who these bus operators were and what happened, but we also know some people had become statistics as a result of that thing. Yes, Mr. Sogoni.
Chair, I think that this is a big issue, Chair. And if we say, I mean, the issue that you're raising, that must be resolved, I think that is quite appreciated. However, Chair, maybe the fears that I do have, I'm not a department, but also as a member of parliament, we also have what you call a responsibility. You know, the fear that I have, the DG says from that time, and no one says from the what you call or treasury, now DG, you wrong. It didn't start that from that time. We hear that there was another what you call presentation to the portfolio committee, maybe with more meat than we have here. You see, Chair, should we, what you call, perhaps go back there? And if we're going back there to 2005, what happened after 2000, when there was insufficient funds or allocation between 2005, 2006, up to date? I suspect that we'll really be opening ourselves up as government for all kinds of what you call it things. I'm not saying that it was right to not to fund properly. I agree with that. I mean, with the issues that have been raised, that our people, they find themselves wherever they are, not because they want to be there, but because of the kind of the situation that it is. It's really a political debate that we are, what you call it, engaged in. But I think that, to me, the issue is that why don't we say we have recognized the problem now, that we have all recognized the problem. What do we do moving forward so that we do not experience that call. Maybe when transport was saying, look, we're really having problems with this. People didn't understand. Now we've been taken to court now. We're forced now, through our necks now, to pay. You can't say no. You can't pay. They have to pay. So everybody now, it has come to the realization of everyone that what Department of Transport has been saying perhaps was true. Sometimes you tighten your belt, you tighten it too much to the extent that you can no longer eat. But now, as I say, I'm saying, Chair, I do understand the question that you're raising about the period up to now. But I think that for me, it's important to say we have learned from those mistakes of the past. How do we move forward now so that we do not find ourselves there next time? Even now that we are realizing this, I mean the times that we are living in terms of economic, what you call a situation in the country, it will always call for what perhaps Mr. Brown or even the teacher was saying, that the choices that all the time we have to make when we render these services. But also, I mean, the whole thing that as government we have not yet...
Let me just point. You see, there's this thing called overdraft and what have you and what have you. Overspending. There always are two things. One of the things you do is you write off. That's the one option. Secondly is you pay and close the gap. And so I'm saying it can be a situation that we recognize it, because it remains. And so through discussion, it can be resolved. I think that's the issue I'm saying. Taking into account the lessons that you've spoken about, the bottom line is, through discussion, what is it that between the two departments and government broadly can be done to address it? The whole government-wide. Because it's part and parcel of the mandates of government. Not just a department, but broadly government. Because it is a South African responsibility that must be provided by government. And so what does it mean? It means government must then go back and reprioritize to address and resolve that problem. That's the issue I'm raising. I'm not saying we're opening a can of worms. But it's not a can of worms, it's a way government can take a choice and say, alright, in terms of these matters, we put this aside and this aside and this aside in order to deal with this matter. The CFO seems to have something to say as a solution.
Jesus, maybe not a solution, but I could just elaborate on the way forward, possibly. If we look back, the problem was caused, as the DG mentioned already, by the interim contracts, because the interim contracts take up 66% of the subsidy, and they ran from month to month. So the department could have cancelled those contracts, or could have asked the provinces to cancel those contracts. And from a pure financial point of view, that's what I would have personally done. But the consequences, you would understand, would have been very severe. Financially, what's happened is that since the court cases were against the Department of Transport, Treasury agreed to give us the cash, but they cannot give us the appropriation that is subject to parliamentary approval of an appropriation. Treasury also indicated that it was too late for a special adjusted budget, seeing the upcoming elections. So having received the cash from Treasury, we were able to pay what we had to pay. We will be paying the February claims in March and the March claims in April. Those amounts, less whatever we can scrounge in the department's budget, will constitute unauthorized expenditure. Now, Treasury will report to Parliament on the amounts of the unauthorized expenditure and will make recommendations how that should be dealt with. If Parliament approves the unauthorized expenditure with funding, the money would be forthcoming, and essentially the department will be covered. If not, even if the unauthorized expenditure is approved but not with funding, that shortfall, which we estimate now to be 911 million in the current financial year, and after the March claims to total about 1.3 billion, would then have to come off of the future budget. They would have to be written off in the against the department's budget, meaning that we would have to take that money from elsewhere. And the only elsewhere where the department, which is not earmarked for specific purposes, remain, and the only larger amounts in the areas of road and rail. DTIS is entrenched in the Division of Revenue Act. So
it can be resolved. It does look like it can be resolved. DG?
Honourable Chairperson, that would be the straightforward response to the treatment of the challenge. So we'll be back at COPA and doing all of those things. The reality, though, is that the budget allocation for, because this thing happened in November, the 9-10 budget allocations were complete by then, would have needed a special adjustment to correct it that didn't exist for us because of the short term of Parliament. What it needs is the 10-11 allocation to be done for the bus subsidies by National Treasury as part of our MTF allocation we're going for in June to deal with the real subsidy figures, the deficit going back in the period, and the new growth that we know and can predict will happen for future allocations. That's the only way Chairperson will get out of this problem, is if there's that formula is what gets allocated to future bus subsidies taking us into the future. Without those three elements, I think we'll remain in trouble.
And this is why I'm saying, because you are human beings, you can always engage and find each other in terms of those three elements. Is that not possible?
No, I understand the question. I don't think as a committee we can discuss it and resolve it. No, you are right, Honorable Chair. I think let's move right up to the point when the expenditure is authorized. Right? And if it's authorized with money, then we would have been debating unnecessarily. If it's authorized without money, then these points will be put on the agenda to say how. Now we must deal with A, B, C, and D. Treasury, tell us where do we get the money. And then we then deal with it there. But I think to avoid us getting there, we possibly need to just on a continuous basis put it on the agenda and discuss it on a continuous basis.
Yes, yes, Mr. Sokot.
Oh, it closed it. I had done, as you know, my briefing for the province on Thursday. There's another element. And I think that this presentation also speaks to that element, or I saw it somewhere. It says this subsidy supplements. I hope that Shadar as well is listening. It says this subsidy supplements. I saw that that word elsewhere, and it's not just what you call it. I mean, if that word is there, now the province says we don't have money. We don't know what is it supplementing, because we want the subsidies, in other words, that they are getting. If it's expected that the province should provide something, they do not have the, what to call the money. So all I'm saying is that if that is correct, I think part of the discussion should include those issues that at a provincial level, they don't have the, what to call it, the money.
Look, I think this is what Mr. Brown was raising earlier about the equitable share now. We know what had happened in the Eastern Cape in terms of the equitable share. We don't know what had happened in other provinces in terms of the equitable share. And maybe, therefore, that's another discussion. Because if provinces would then say we don't have money if this is supplementing, it's because clearly if people are also not budgeting appropriately in the equitable set, and if they just say we don't have money when they were given a budget in the context of the equitable share, then there's a problem.
Sure. I want the treasurer and the department to help us here. My understanding is that the budget of the provinces never included the subsidy. Subsidy has always been a national responsibility. That's why today they say that they do not have the money for the subsidy.
The key question is, where does this function reside? Who's responsible for this function, if you think about it? So if this is then a provincial function, then surely the province should come to the party when it comes to it and reprioritize in a way to support this particular function. No, I mean, if one looks at how provinces allocate their budgets, Honorable Chair, the Premier's office budgets growing, the legislature's budget is growing significantly, and all of that. That is the reprioritization that I'm talking about. It will have to happen. Thank you.
Chairperson, there are allocations that are made by provincial governments in relation to this issue of provision of public transport. This amount, which comes via the National Department, is by far the biggest source. But it is indeed, we put it another way and say, this amount is normally supplemented by provincial allocations, if you take the proportions, not the other. This is by far the largest amount. Then they get supplemented. But there are so many challenges in these areas, Chairperson, that one, we have no influence of the prioritization and the equitable share at provincial level, and how much of that is used for supplementing. And because this source exists, I can guarantee you that the provincial component will always reduce because of the existence of this fund, particularly in the face of other priorities. We know that, and that's exactly what happens and transpires. The reality, though, is the reason we need to give the certainty, which is what DORA will provide us, is then that the provinces can sit down and say, our amount is confirmed at X. In their own budgeting processes, we will supplement it with Y, and therefore are able to provide services that are this level in our province. We cannot exceed that amount, because if we do, at least in the DORA provisions, we are not allowed to do that. That helps us to resolve those issues. But lastly, there are additional complicated issues that are in relation to the old boundaries. Now, Gauteng is able to supplement, but Gauteng still provides a service to both Mpumalanga and Northwest. Eastern Cape has big issues around the old TBVC states and the bus services that are related to that. So even that re-engineering of those arrangements is quite critical for us to get to a clean arrangement, most people on tendered contracts, in a new system, with as much money as we can afford as we prioritize public transport, with the shortfall clearly recognized as something a third world country like us can't do anything about. So that there is always going to be a shortfall, because we can never provide enough buses for the number of people who need them. But at least we can ensure certain categories of people are provided for. One of the things we got excited about, Chair, thought we would do is re-engineer the routes of these areas. Those people still live there in those townships. They need to get to work. The route doesn't change. You can make it kilometer-based. It doesn't change. They leave Butsabelo and go to Bromfontein. They have so for the last 20 years. So you can say, well, what is route design in that context? What are you asking us to do? To pretend people don't live in Butsabelo? They live in Butsabelo. They have to go to Mangaung. And that route remains the same kilometers. There are just more people on it. That's the reality.
Okay. Look, and this is why I think the Minister of Finance says the incoming president must have a big report on this budget review thing. Clearly, we shall be picking up some of these things, especially in the provinces, for me, but also in the budgets of municipalities, by the way. I mean, we've seen those budgets. Of course, yeah. Right. I think we have had a serious discussion on this matter. Thank you very much, DG. And here comes the department that might also assist you.
Just one question, Madam Chair, that was not raised. I saw that RAF is meant to generate its own, what you call, resources, because there's no budget this year. Is the reading correct? I don't know what slide is that, but I saw that there's no allocation for 2009, 2010. And we do know that every year RAF comes with your cap. So can you do this year? Why is it perhaps that no, it's not budgeted for? RAF. It's on page 5, yes.
Honorable Chairperson, with your permission, can I just indicate there are two elements to RAF, and there are two slides I'd like the Honorable Member to refer to. If you like, we can call this capital, even though in RAF terms it's not capital. If you turn to slide 10, you will then see what are normal allocations to RAF. The challenge is that that thing that I'm calling capital there of 2.5 billion was really a balloon payment, a rescue emergency payment to save us in a liquidity crisis. That was what 2.5 billion was about. This amount is really then to help us supplement some of the operational issues which will get RAF to operate efficiently. It's introducing the policy issues and a whole lot of other initiatives. One of the things that the policy requires is that we no longer depend on lawyers to process claims. We establish RAF desks at hospitals so that people go and apply for themselves or the RAF officials go to the hospital beds. I can tell you, Honorable Member, the lawyers are fighting us hand, tooth, knife, bazooka and all. Principally because this has just been a cash cow the legal system has used in this country for too long. They've taken us to court on every instance to prevent us from restructuring RAF sufficiently so that we don't depend on them. So we deliver the service from the RAF to the people. No lawyer in between. They've employed the best lawyers amongst themselves they have to fight these cases. But the reality is that we'll just continue spending that 13.3 in restructuring those arrangements and just ignoring them. Yes, that's million, but it's for the policy and the restructuring issues. That will mean that in the future we must never need another balloon payment like that 2.5 billion. Because the 2.5 billion was really just to rescue us. We had claims this high, we couldn't pay. That's the crime. But there's also adjustments that were announced by the Minister of Finance in his budget speech in the levy, which gives us a little better liquidity arrangement with respect to this. So hopefully, with these interventions, with the increase in the levy, we'll never come back begging for a balloon payment again, hopefully. But you must keep track, Chairperson and Honorable Members, of the court cases we are fighting. Then you'll know whether we're winning this battle or whether we're losing it. But it's very difficult to fight legal associations and lawyers in courts. We're fighting them on their terrain, and it's a very difficult battle to win. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Vijay and your team. We will be monitoring the space. Of course, these lawyers, these cases, etc. Public Works has got an actress today on behalf of the DG. She's the CFO acting on behalf of the DG. Let's hear what they've got to say. They've got brand new money.
Chairperson, on behalf of myself and the CFO, and not a delegation from Transport, we'd like to thank you for the opportunity, and please do excuse us, Chairperson, as we take our leave. Thank you. Thank you very much.
EPWP extended incentive, and what is this thing called? Devolution of property rights. What's it, madam?
Let me start by apologizing for. Thanks, Chair. I'm acting on behalf of the DG, who is engaged in another urgent meeting with the Minister. I'm the Chief Financial Officer. I'm here with two of my colleagues. Stanley Henderson is our DDG EPWP, acting DDG EPWP, and Ismail Akalaya is our Chief Director, Partnership Arrangements. Chair, I'm going to present our inputs that are in the Division of Revenue Bill. We'll start with the background on EPWP. This is a new incentive grant that has been included in the DOLA, and we thought that we should first give you the background on how it is going to unfold from the 1st of April 2009, and then I'll also give you then progress on the devolution of property rates, which started from April 2008. Let me just hand over to Stanley just to give the background, then I'll come in on the budget side.
I think, Chair, it might be better if we go through the presentation immediately and please continue and take a question.
Thanks, Chair. I think maybe if I can continue with the background.
You see, Brown, they're trying to end their subject.
They're trying to justify.
Rather than spend the public word.
Proceed. They're all trying to make each other speak now.
Chair, I think thanks, Honourable Chairperson. Yes, I think as the CFO indicated, just a brief background is to the EPWP Phase 1. And I think it's been widely publicized that we've achieved our targets of 1 million work opportunities a year ahead of schedule. Something that I don't think we've sufficiently acknowledged and celebrated. The second phase of the EPWP is to scale up further to contribute significantly to halving unemployment. Clearly, part of the midterm review we've done on the program, etc., says that the program is beneficial, it's working, and it's impacting on people. But clearly, if you look at the scale of unemployment in South Africa, it's too small. And that's why EPWP Phase 2 is designed specifically to increase the number of people to benefit from it and contribute directly to halving unemployment. Where we are, Honorable Chair, is that Cabinet approved the high-level proposals way back in June
4.2 billion rand was allocated over the MTF, or is allocated over the MTF, to scale up the program. And I think this, as the CFO indicated, is the EPWP incentive. And I think it's very important to know this is a new type of incentive. It's something that government has not tried before. It's not a planning-based allocation, but it's a performance-based allocation. So municipalities and provinces can get this allocation if they achieve certain EPWP outcomes within their existing budgets. But the CFO will talk more on that. We've also been to the President's Coordinating Committee, and we've got an agreement that the Department of Public Works will set targets for provinces and municipalities, and they will report on them to DPW quarterly. I think it's also a huge step forward. In phase one, we had the 1 million target, but there was no ownership from provinces and municipalities to their contribution. I think what we're starting and doing in phase two is to ensure that we have that political approval or endorsement of the targets ahead of schedule, so that provinces and municipalities are clear as to what they're contributing to it. All of this is designed that we need to be ready, up and running, for the incentive to start working from 1 April next year. Just to contextualize it, sorry, this is a new slide, but where it comes from, I think on February the 6th in the State of the Nation address, the President said that as part of the contribution to income of the poor, the target for 1 million work opportunities to the EPWP was attained. I mentioned that. Basically saying that this has created the possibility massively to expand this program and improve its quality, and that's where phase two is. If we further look at the budget speech of the Minister Trevor Manuel, and they propose that participating department, provinces and municipalities should be challenged to exceed their targets for creating EPWP jobs over the period ahead. So the contingency reserve this year has been increased to allow for additional funding of employment projects in 2009. Adjustments appropriation if sufficient progress is made. Essentially what Treasury is saying is that because job creation is such a key objective of government, that resources will be found if this incentive is utilized by provinces and municipalities as it has been intended. If I can just look at the goal of phase two and just to explain the difference from phase one. We're now measuring a new thing called full-time equivalent. And the goal is to create 2 million full-time equivalent jobs for poor and unemployed people in South Africa, so as to contribute to halving unemployment by 2014 through the delivery of public and community services. Now, the full-time equivalent is the measure we've used to set targets for provinces and municipalities. Essentially, we've been criticized, if I can try and explain, when we calculated work opportunities in year one, there was no way to distinguish the length of the work opportunity. So some work opportunities were short and some were long, were ongoing. But given that we now have an incentive, we're trying to figure out what is the full-time equivalent job that will be created. We're trying to measure. Let me give you a full-time equivalent. We take the person days of employment and we divide it by 230. 230 being a working year, if you take away the public holidays and the weekends. So we can then say we effectively employ 2 million. We've created 2 million jobs of a year duration. Sometimes that job, that full-time equivalent job, can be shared by two people. But that's just an explanation of it. My colleague Stanley Henderson is an expert. He can clarify it if the members are not still satisfied with it. Mr. Henderson, do you want to... We'll come to your question. So if we can just look at, if you look at where we are, we want to scale the program up from about 210,000 full-time equivalents in year one to about 610,000 full-time equivalent jobs in year five. And it equates to 4.5 million work opportunities. So you need to compare the 4.5 million to the original 1 million that we had in phase one to understand that this program is increasing fourfold. And it's quite a substantial increase. But it is to enable government to act as an employer of last resort as part of the anti-poverty strategy. I think what's also worth mentioning is that government has a range of programs dealing with unemployment and poverty, and EPWP is just one initiative targeting essentially those people who are willing and able to work but who cannot find work. Okay. If I can quickly look at the critical success factors for EPWP2, again, out of the midterm review, we were told that we must expand the program. and we should focus on it and not try and be distracted by other objectives which may be secondary. We need to look at clear political and administrative accountability for EPWP work creation targets across the spheres of government. Again, I think the PCC resolution helps us, and we would encourage and we would be working with premiers and mayors to ensure that they report on the EPWP performance. Align EPWP outputs with the core mandates of programs. I think that's consistent with phase one. We want departments to do their normal mandates, to implement their normal mandates, but apply a look at how labor intensity can increase and how we can employ more people to deliver those same standards and those same services. The fiscal incentive, as I've mentioned, that's the new allocation, and our CFO will talk a little bit more to it. And the last point there, Chair, is we've looked at if we want to contribute to halving unemployment, the state itself does not have the capacity to create sufficient number of jobs to significantly impact on unemployment. So we are looking at ways in which we can partner with the non-state sector. And here we're looking at NGOs, CBOs, to bring them on board to help contribute to the EPWP targets. Chair, what's listed below is just the outline which the CFO will talk through, and we'll go through each one. The targets and accountability across government, the fiscal incentive, how it actually works, the non-state sector, and we'll talk also about technical support spheres, sectors, and implementing bodies. And I think there is an acknowledgement. We've got resources from National Treasury to expand the EPWP unit to ensure that we provide support to those municipalities and provinces who are not participating but who would like to come on. The targets, I mean, should we proceed? Okay. Just in terms of the full-time equivalent targets, we've broken down. If you look at the 2 million full-time equivalents, that's just the breakdown across provinces national. Okay. Five-year targets versus targets for the provinces. Okay. CFO, do you want to take over from here?
All glamorous things there, and this is what I'm just saying, proceed. Because all of those things I know sometimes are going to be problematic to achieve.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Basically, these are the amounts that have been included in our allocation for the new MTEF. As I have mentioned previously, that we don't have a baseline. This is a new incentive scheme. The department has been allocated 465 million for the financial year 2009-10 and 1.3 billion. It increases to 2.3 billion in 2011-2012. That is the breakdown where provinces over the 3-year period, they will receive 1.3 billion, 1.4 billion, municipalities 1.9 billion, and non-state sector, which is your NGOs, your private sector, which comes to about 748 million. The other line is provision for capacity. For this program, National Treasury also realized that we need to capacitate the department to be able to manage the incentives and to be able also to assist the non-state sector to be able to also contribute to this initiative. Therefore, the total cost of, to intermediary, that is the cost that has been allocated to provide support to the non-state sector. Basically, this slide just shows you the baseline to say that brown line, FTEs, that is the work opportunities reported by provinces for 2007-2008. This is what they did within the given baselines or in the provinces. Now, the next column there shows you the baseline that has been worked out by Public Works to say, this is what you must achieve for you to begin to enjoy the incentives. And that is the total that is expected. They will get the incentives if they reach those targets as they are reflected in the column that starts with entire
government. What are you saying?
Honorable Chair, honorable members, the first column, the FTEs, those are the numbers that have been reported by the provinces to say these are the work opportunities that we've created in
2007-2008. That 11,000,
yes,
are those opportunities that were created in the last financial year?
Yes, 2007-2008.
In KZN?
Yes, that's what they report.
And that amount, 2906, is that the amount?
That's the total of that whole column.
No, man. EP allocation. Or allocation, what is
allocation
that?
Allocation, what we are going to pay.
No, no, I'm saying
these are just work created. One, two, three columns, it's full-time equivalent work created.
Okay.
And the baseline.
Uh-huh.
Now, from the allocation, the 199 million, that is the amount that we are going to pay.
All right, let's just get each other. Now, you're getting a report from KZN that says in the last financial year we created 11,000 jobs.
Yes.
Now, what is the target this time? Mm-hmm. My bad, I'm asking, what is then the target of the FETs in the current financial year in KZN?
If I can maybe come in there. If we look at the third column, that's the target. So the 16,551
now,
the target we put in for KZN.
Hang on. How do you determine that?
That is based on their performance plus a 10% increase. So we've looked at those municipalities and institutions that were performing and we gave them a 10% increase. For those that were not performing, we've given them a 20% increase as a target. If I can maybe clarify, if you look at column 1 and column 2, column 2 says for the budget that goes to the province, this is the amount of full-time equivalent jobs they should have created. The first column shows you what they actually reported. So the ideal situation is that column 1 should be greater than column 2. So you can see KZN in this context is doing very well, but Western Cape is not doing well at all because they are way below what they target, what they should have reported.
Chair, let them article report to us and finish the presentation. We really want to engage with it.
Then going to the second column from the end, this is... Or the loose sheet. You can, there's one on the table. We noted it was confusing, that's why we didn't want to include it. Thanks, Chair. The indicative allocation, that's what we are going to pay if they reach those targets with the heading entire province. Now, we've realized that the fiscal period for municipalities and national departments is different. So, in the new financial year starting 1st April, we'll be able to pay them just 50%, the second two quarters, because the municipalities' fiscal year will end after we've paid the two quarters, but the other two quarters will be paid in the next financial year. This is just the distance between the financial year ends of the two spheres of government. You can go to the next one.
Chair, on this one, we were trying to respond to the question that says this program is focused on
your metro, urban, metropolitan areas as opposed to rural. So we were just trying to lift Eastern Cape to say included in those municipalities are those that are municipalities in the rural areas. The EPWP incentive is based on paying all public bodies that create work above a minimum threshold. Yes, so we just wanted to show you that it's 51 people for every day of work created. There is 4.1 billion that has been allocated throughout the MTEF. Eligible public bodies who want to participate in the incentive will enter into an agreement with GPW. basis for measuring EPW performance is just the number of FTEs per million rand of infrastructure budget, taking into account the different portfolios of infrastructure and the rate at which each can contribute to employment. And maybe you can go to the next slide. This is just a slide on the incentive to show you eligibility of the different municipalities to say what is it that is expected so that they can be able to start enjoying these privileges. Safe to say, from the department there is a very focused unit, a chief directorate that is looking after monitoring and evaluation, because the question has been how are we going to monitor these incentives to make sure that when the municipalities and provinces report, the amounts that we are going to pay are based on credible information. There is a whole chief directorate that we have within the department, and we are also going to build capacity within financial management and our internal audit sections to make sure that we are able to manage these grants, especially that it is the first time that we will be giving out such grants. Chair, if I could go to the devolution, because the rest would be the almost the same story that we had on the incentive.
Okay. Now, you have decided to target 45 municipalities. Why?
Chair, I think if we look at the eligibility criteria that the CFO was talking to, because the incentive is based on performance, not all public bodies participate. We are basically saying you need to prove to us. On EPWP, that's correct.
Okay. For the current financial year 08-09, the department was allocated 889 million for the devolution. And in the next coming MTEF, the budget has been increased to 996 million, billion and to 1.1 billion. For the MTEF, excluding 08-09, in total, the department has received about 3.2 billion for this. The allocation criteria was extracted from the National Public Works Asset Register, as reported also in the framework, and the calculations were based on the on what we paid in the 2006-07 financial year. Achievements to date, from the total budget of the 889, 667 was transferred to the provincial treasuries, who in return would transfer to the provincial departments of public works. The last tranche was transferred in February 2009, which was 222 million. The list of properties were also verified, and the degree of accuracy ranged from 95 to 99% depending on the involvement of the province. Training was also provided to all provincial departments. The performance of the money was paid over to the municipalities by the provincial departments of public works, because they have to pay based on the invoicing from the municipalities. Yeah. Okay. Training was provided to all provincial departments as agreed in the framework. 8 out of the 9 provinces are on IE Works. They are paying the municipalities through a system that was developed by Public Works to pay over to municipalities. The municipality that is not using this is KZN, because they have their own different system that they are using to pay municipalities. Quarterly performance reports were also submitted by provincial departments of agriculture. The process has now been fully of public works. Uh, there are no implications. Basically, what you're saying is that we have been able to roll out the system so that they are able to pay municipalities. KZN, the difference is only that they have their own system called Premise that they are using to pay the municipalities. The payment schedule for next year has also been amended. We also realized that according to the framework, we were paying in August, September, and February. We've amended that to start paying from June so that the provincial departments can pay on time. The next one. Challenges, obtaining funding from National Treasury to clear the area rates. You see that the challenges are only on the area rates. When we devolved the funding for the property rates, it was effective from the 1st of April 2008, and it was zero-based. We said to the provinces, we will take care of the backlog. Anything that we owed prior to 1st of April 2008, the National Department will pay. But they are supposed to start paying from April 2008 with the budget that we have devolved. Now, at that time when the decision was taken, it was premised on the belief that the department was going to get additional money from National Treasury to be able to address the arrears. The money did not come through, and that is the only area that we are currently trying to finalize and sort out with the National Treasury and also with the different provinces. I must say, four provinces managed to clear their arrears. Those that are listed there are the only ones that are still having arrears from all the rates that were accumulated whilst the national office was taking responsibility of all the payment for all the buildings of the state. I don't want to put it in that manner, another member, because we are working very closely with them. They've shown a lot of interest in assisting us in this regard. They haven't promised any money, but they are promising to assist us to reconcile, because some of the municipalities are actually the creator of this program because they didn't have systems to bill for those rates. There's reconciliation and validation of the claimed arrears that has to be done because most of those municipalities cannot validate the reports that they've submitted. Capacity also to conduct the validation has been a challenge. To this end, the department is working closely with National Treasury to achieve the above, and there are ongoing meetings to make sure that we talk to the municipal managers. There is also a parallel process of reviewing the readiness of provinces because we are saying as public works that when we devolved the grants, at the same time we were assessing the readiness of the provinces to have this included in their baseline so that this does not come through the division of revenue, but it forms the equitable shares in their baseline and earmarked in their baseline to avoid this challenge. I think in terms of the current rates, we don't have a program. It's only the areas where we are still stuck with owing municipalities millions of money.
Okay, thank you, madam. Okay, let's start with the last discussion, devolution of property rights. Comments, questions?
You know, I was laughing because I just didn't understand. I thought that I was following the CFO. That National Trust is not paying. Now, when I say to myself, so National Trust is not a good customer, because Transport Department said National Trust was not paying. She says, no, we're working very well closely. But here, bullet number four there also still speaks to the outstanding amounts that National Trust has not, what you call it, paid. So I think that we should be upfront, CFO, that National Treasury is not coming to dinner. So they must pay. Because we spoke to, when did we meet the provinces? Around September or so. They were complaining that the amounts were gazetted, but the amounts physically, the cash did not, what to call it, come to them. Now, it's clear that
Mathematics must settle that outstanding balance. That's what we have to call a bullet for says.
Because the provinces, they complain that they can only pay the to municipalities on condition that they receive this allocation. And in terms of the in the provincial equitable share, I don't think that there's an allocation for that to come in their provincial equitable share. So money will only come from you to the province, to municipalities. That's one. But the other issue, Chair, is the, I mean, in relation to this grant, I'm talking devolution. I'm not going to the other what you call it thing. Yes. Now I'll come back to this question that I marked in.
Chairperson, when I stay within devolution, I am pleased at least to learn that the asset register situation has been improved, because when you talk of list of properties were verified, to me I think you talk about the list, the asset register, because it has been a problem for years. But now you say here 95% to 99% depending on provinces. So it suggests to me that the upcoming committee will require to see the progress in terms of provinces, because it may happen that there are those provinces who are still far behind in taking up this issue. Well, of course, we has talked to question of these areas, because that has been the problem as well. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, Chair, I think that I when you say list of properties were verified and blah blah to 95%. Now I'm just kind of confused of what was the intention, the whole objective of this. Money, this devolution of the Vatican. I'm not very clear.
Contradicting me. When she was saying background, I said we know it. It's right in front of you. I said she must pass it. We know the background. There it is.
Now, Chair, I'm not contradicting you in any way, because I just want to be clear that maybe my thinking and this understanding is correct. And two, is this, I think the main question that really I wanted to ask is around the achievements. The achievements say so much money, that there was a budget, purchase was that amount, then the other amount was transferred, and the other one, the balance was transferred in 2022. Now the contradiction that I get is that there's still money. The last, what they call a bullet, for instance, speaks to challenges that National Treasury has not yet paid for the other Western Cape, KZN, Mpumalanga. Now, and then I seem to get confused as to exactly why was this 889 and I mean that bullet there, bullet one on achievement. Bullet one on achievement seemed to be saying that now the budget has been cleared, everybody has been paid. The other bullet there, in the last bullet, says no, National Treasury was actually not allocated for these other provinces. So what is the story exactly? Thank you.
No, what is the story?
Okay.
What is the story? You're saying 660 something has been transferred. Has that been spent, or is it sitting in the banks in the provinces? I think that is the issue arising. Number two, my colleagues are disappointing me. Maybe they have forgotten these things. We had a big discussion with provincial departments of public works, all of them. Let me give you a good example. Northwest was saying they were given 58 million rand. Mafikeng only was owed 30 million rand. And so the province did not know what to do with the rest of the municipalities, because they were not able to pay Mafikeng because they were scared of paying half a million rand to one municipality, 1 million to the other, whereas they had spent 30 million to Mafikeng. Have you resolved that? That was a big issue for all the provinces. In other words, the allocations given to provinces at the time were this problematic. But number two, the legacy debt was for your own. You were supposed to deal with the legacy debt yourselves. Now we see you saying National Treasury must pay your arrears, whereas you are supposed to deal with what was called the legacy debt. Now, have you then dealt with the issues that related to the allocations to the provinces in respect of the municipalities, in the context of this thing I'm raising as an example for Northwest and Mafikeng, because that says they've done a proper audit, and Mafikeng only, out of about 20-something municipalities, was owed 30 million rand. And of course, the 200 plus would seem to be some underspending, if you like, because of the 880-something you've just transferred, you're not yet sure whether that's spent, or you have not spent, still transferred. And so the 200 plus would be underspending.
Just the last one is the, I don't know if the department has a monitoring mechanism on this, because despite the fact that this money, this responsibility now has been transferred to provinces. Which last province did we visit as this committee? But to all provinces that we have visited, we found that national departments have not paid the municipalities, have not paid for their yes. So now that's why I'm raising, we're asking the question that have you got monitoring and evaluation systems, or you transfer the money, you walk away?
Thanks, Chair. Let me start with the first one on the Mafikeng one, the example of Mafikeng. When the budgets were devolved, there was an agreement to say we are devolving the amounts based on the information that Public Works had in 2006-07. Whatever rates that we were paying, that's what we devolved. And there was an understanding that anything above that, the provinces will have to carry, including the new Municipality Act that came into being. There was an understanding that if those, for instance, with the increase in the rates, the provinces were supposed to provide for that. And also, in the process, there were other...
it's simple. Northwest was given 58 million rand.
Yes.
Now, of that, we were told 30 million rand was only for Mafikeng. And so the remainder, 28 million, was to be given to all the other municipalities. In other words, we're not yet speaking about Rustenburg, which
Pink, Rustenburg, and even Glaxtop. Proceed.
Thanks, Chair. I'm not aware of that specific case. Perhaps we could respond to Mafikeng as to how did they end up with the 58. But the basis, that is why I showed that slide to say the criteria of allocation was based on the information that was sitting at the national office. And agreed upon with the provinces to say, these are the municipalities that we have been paying rates on your behalf. And they had to go and verify. Anything above what was verified was supposed to be carried by the province. That was the agreement. I just want to check if I've got a copy. Somewhere in the framework there should be something close to that, because we spoke about zero based and the basis of allocation. Can respond in writing to you and give you the details. Okay. The legacy debt, yes, the national department agreed when they devolved the budgets to say, provinces, you take responsibility from the 1st of April 2008. We will deal with the legacy. That is the fund that never came through from national treasury. But for various reasons, because there was a lot of verification and validation of information coming from the municipalities to enable us to pay. For instance, some of the submissions that came to me, it was just an Excel spreadsheet where the municipality was saying you owe rates and taxes dating back from 1999 or 1994. But some of the municipalities did not have systems. That is why if you look at those that are still having arrears, are usually your small or remote municipalities, mostly in the rural areas where there were no systems. So we are still trying to the target has been moving all the time. You know, they are not able to say this is how much you owe. At some point it was 12 million, then it escalated to 70 million. So what we are doing now is to sit with the various provinces to look at how best can we cap the figure. Because National Treasury is saying, give us soft documents, clear evidence, and the total figure so that we can assist you. But the municipalities are not able to give us that kind of information. That is why we need to engage with them to say, if you are giving us an Excel spreadsheet, you know, how do we get evidence to say this is what the province is owing? On the other side, as public works, we need to also reconcile to say, what did we pay previously to those municipalities?
Let me assist a bit. I'm worried if the CFO talks about only a spreadsheet coming in and they made a decision based on the spreadsheet. On your question around Mafeking, maybe what the CFO doesn't explain is these are properties that were predominantly former House of Representative properties, former House of Delegates, former House of Assembly, and the former TBBC states. So what you have, why Mafeking would be high, is because a lot of the former Botswana properties were actually then located in there. Hence in Rustenburg you may not necessarily have the case. Those ones would in any case have been funded by the Northwest government out of their own equitable share. So basically there. When the devolution had to take place, the treasuries and provinces had ordered, again an underfunded mandate is coming our way. Go national, cost this thing, and based on its costing, have it as a conditional grant so that we clearly can see where this and the extent to which this should be funded in terms of that. Now, what is shown here is the money that has been transferred. Of that money that has been transferred, in fact, of the total allocation, I think only 51%, as of the end of January, has been spent of this money, which is a concern. Now, where does this arise? Because on the arrears side, in any case, this should have been resolved basically long ago. Now, given that there's underspending, why can't even that money then be used to settle whatever arrears there are, for that matter?
Chair, it's not a case of settling the arrears. It's about verifying information, making sure that whatever we are paying for is correct, is credible. I spoke about spreadsheet. We are not refusing to pay the arrears. And I think it's in our best interest also to make sure that they are resolved. But the process of validating information is problematic.
Then the bottom line is that we are sitting with underspending, okay, which is it's a fact. Right, let's go then to the EPWP incentive now. Zul, you had many questions on that one.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I thought I've got the minister's speech here. I wanted to, because I hope that that will help me. I was trying just to go through it again. But my understanding was that when the minister delivered his speech, he was saying, now we're going to move away from your old, this 2 weeks, 1 day, what you call it thing, and count number of days that have been worked. But to a situation where at least now people will be able to work longer, what you call a term of this. So the example, for instance, the easiest example will be your caregiver. That the caregivers be what you call it, be paid, and they work that long term. And some what you call it, or infrastructural thing. So that you move away from this path. But from this presentation, and that's why we were struggling to get it, what does that full-time equivalent mean? But we could not get the explanation, you know. We thought that it would clarify that part, whether it means that or it means something else. But I don't know, we suggested that we move on because we could not get the clarity.
Somebody must again simplify it. Full-time equivalent. Is it something like if somebody goes to work at 8, is it somebody who knocks off at 2? Is it somebody who does not have lunch and therefore would not knock off at 4 ordinarily? I mean, I'm just trying to think full-time employment would be 8 to 4. And so on and so on. And so full-time equivalent, what would it mean? Would it be 8:30 to 3:30, 8:30 to 8, no lunch, no break, no nothing, no other benefits? What are you really saying?
Thank you. Chair, sorry, are we still now, are they now picked up clarifying that part? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. One of the biggest criticisms against phase one of the EPWP was that we say we have created 1 million work opportunities, but many of those work opportunities would be short in duration and others longer. Give an example, given in the infrastructure sector, given the project-based nature of many of the contributors, sometimes you get a project, say, between from 4 to 6 months. In the social sector, we would have people working for a period of 18 months to 24 months, those kind of thing. So the FTE, the full-time equivalent, is simply a way of ensuring that we can measure if a person would have been working for an entire year, a person would have worked for 230 days. That's 1 year of full employment. That's an FTE. So what we're doing with the data that we collect is saying we divide all the data through 230, it'd be saying, so in EPWP phase 2, we would like to create at least 2 million FTEs, full-time equivalents, which means the 4.5 million work opportunities. If we convert the person days of work there into FTEs, it should give us at least 2 million FTEs, and we are just for the sake of comparison, so we can in essence why, and we know of course at National Treasury they're also insisting on the, that we have a more fairer way of comparing, rather than say us telling them we have created X number of work opportunities, and one work opportunity could be perhaps 3 months, another one could have been 9 months. That's a measure to compare with if a person would be working for 1 year continuously.
If I can maybe add.
You know, Chairperson, I'm just glad that my term of office is coming to an end as a public representative. If I have to go to explain, one of my duties at my constituency is to explain the budget. But I'm sure if I were to explain this, I would not be able to explain it. No, because of this part. I may not want to go because of, I may want to avoid this one.
I think if I can maybe just say why we calculate in an FTE. I think Mr. Henderson has explained it. Why we calculate in an FTE. When we looked at the incentive...
It's not assisting to say why. When we're not understanding what it is about, first and foremost. That is the issue. Take it slowly. Take it step by step.
But let me just say why, because I think the why is important. Why is, if we introduce the incentive, we have to compare different municipalities.
Sin.
Yes, I'm going to explain.
I will be coming back to that question of the why. Don't deal with it now.
But it's
fine to ask what this thing is.
Honorable Chair, that's part of the answer, if you just allow me a little bit leeway. Okay. When we want to introduce the incentive, we needed to compare the contributions of different entities. So let's take it at the municipal level. How do we compare the jobs created by Itikweni with the jobs created by Msunduzi? Two different municipalities. We need to bring it down to a common measure. And the common measure is a full-time equivalent job. It's the number of person days worked divided by 230. So it assumes that we are creating a full years of employment. So one full-time equivalent job is the equivalent of an individual working for 230 days.
But still, there's a problem that we still never come back to in this discussion. No. You see, can you rewind and go to the provincial allocations? Municipality allocations, non-state sector allocations, provision for capacity, all of those things. Okay.
Just before we go to that, you know, let's go back to that FT, full-time equivalent slide. No? We're speaking about this full-time equivalent slide, and we're linking it to halving unemployment by 2014. How do we do this? Because my understanding of that, or my manifesto to say by 2014 we will have unemployment, it's talking about people who will be having full-time what you call, who will wake up in the morning and have full-time jobs. Now, this one, I really do not what to call it, or understand it, because unless, that's why I say, if they can just move from the technical staff and just speak our language now on the street, what is meant by this full time? Thanks. Okay, I'll try.
If we deal with the issue of full time jobs, the only way government can create full-time jobs is through employing more civil servants. There is no other way. The EPWP is an emergency short-term intervention which is probably going to be more important given the global financial crisis and economic crisis we're in. We're going to be dealing with large-scale unemployment. We're going to get more retrenchments. And the EPWP is about providing work opportunities. PPWP is because the nature of the job. If you build in a road from point X to point Y, once this road is finished, the jobs finish as well. What our intention to do is to provide more opportunities where people can move from project to project.
If a job is finished, a road is finished, the job is finished, are there no issues of maintaining? Okay.
I think what phase two is trying to do is to provide more opportunities that will provide regular, predictable employment. An expansion in the areas of maintenance is one such strategy. So you're always going to have an EPWP coexisting. Long-term jobs, jobs that are ongoing in nature, and jobs that are short-term. And the only way we can measure them on the same yardstick is to convert them into full-time equivalents.
Chad, perhaps to try and put it more in a layman's words is that the full-time equivalent, I don't think they're implying that one person will be fully employed for 230 days. You can have more than 20, 30 people comprising of the number of days because it's short-term contracts. One person can work for 3 months, the other one can work for 4 months, the other one for 3 days, but at least in that 230 days. So you can have people who have at least worked. Not, you can't equate 230 days to a person working for 230 days per annum.
What we want to strive, just I must add, that we want to get people to work on average across all the programs to 100 days of employment. We don't want to go below that because 100 days is quite substantial. It's almost half a year of work. And that's what we're striving to do. Some of the programs, if I can just add, if you look at the Community Works Program, it's based very much on the model of Zibambele, where people are given 2 days a week work opportunities. And if you calculate that over a year, it equals to 100 days. So increasing of maintenance, bringing in the Community Works Program will ensure that we increase more regular, predictable employment opportunities for people who are willing to work but can't find work.
Chairperson, I wanted to... Okay. Yeah, I wanted to say, all what we're discussing here, to me, my understanding, it takes me to one paragraph here that says, locate clear political and administrative accountability for EPWP work, creation targets across all spheres of government. But there's it means to me it sounds as though the political heads and Mr. will take charge of the whole operation. That's what it means to me. If I'm correct, or if otherwise I misinterpret it, you'll have to tell me.
Yeah, it's indeed important for us that we get, during phase one, we had some sound political buy-in and support. What we are saying in phase two is simply that we have to strengthen this, because it's the only way, if political and administrative heads are held accountable, that's the only way that we can properly, that we will be able to get to the 4.5 million over the 5 years. So we need that kind of buy-in. And that's why we set the targets in conjunction with each and every implementing body, each and every municipality, with participating provinces or provincial departments also. Yes.
Yes, I think what we've also learned from phase one, in particular municipalities where EPWP worked, the common ingredient was political buy-in and an administrator who were willing to implement it. And I think that was a challenge. We couldn't get that in all municipalities. It was a lot of hard work trying to win the municipality over. But I think now with phase two, we said we want those political agreements up front with the premiers and the mayors, and it will proceed.
Still hear your stories. Can you rewind?
Rewind.
I'm not that convinced. Rewind. Let's go to the allocations. Alright, we'll have to have a little discussion here. We will come back to that. You see, the first problem, let's quickly rewind. Phase one performance. Let's go there, quickly. The performance, phase one. The jobs that were there. Yeah. You see, this thing is misleading. I think we must start there. And I think National Treasury and yourselves need to go and do a proper audit here. Now, in the period, I think we need to do a proper audit in the whole period, not just this last financial year. Because there has been a period where KZN, Zibambele, and Gundalashu, Limpopo have been performing way beyond everybody there. Now all of a sudden you see the Eastern Cape is in the last financial year. And this is what I'm saying, this to me is kind of misleading. I think that's the one thing that needs to be verified and verified appropriately. If you go to you can just go back to where I wanted us to talk about the allocations. Right. Now the question I wanted to raise about why, and Mr. Brown knows this question. Why do you really incentivize a fish for swimming? Because it has to swim anyway. Now I'm raising this because to incentivize municipalities to create jobs, when in fact they have to create jobs because their lifeblood is about revenue. And so if they don't create jobs, they would not have a revenue as municipalities. And so why incentivize them for that? I think that's the one thing, don't rush. But number two, you are then saying you're also targeting provinces. What sectors are you really prioritizing in provinces? The non-state sector is, and look, if you talk private sector, I don't have a problem. But when you start talking NGOs and whoever, then there are problems there for me. How, I mean, do NGOs create jobs really? Part of the big problem that we all know is that it's always so difficult to get reports from NGOs. But then the biggest challenge in respect of NGOs and CPOs for that matter is the tension that is between them and municipalities. Now if you're going to create EPWP jobs in municipalities, those things must be in line with IDPs. Municipalities are responsible for IDPs. Now, how do you then deal with that in the context of a tension between an NGO, CPO, and a municipality? And so I'm saying, you're creating tensions and problems here. For me, that money should not even go to NGOs, if you like. It should go straight to municipalities, because that's where IDPs are done. In fact, even the money that's going to provinces is problematic. Because part of one of the conditions, Mr. Brown and yourselves, you might be looking at, is to what extent are some of the provincial departments participating in IDPs? What we've heard ourselves is that every provincial department sends junior officials, and therefore to the extent that they send senior officials to IDP engagement meetings, that for me would constitute part of the condition. And so if a department, provincial department, does not comply with that, it should not receive that incentive in the context of these things. Because majority of these jobs surely on the ground are in municipal areas. I think I've raised quite a number for now. You want to respond? I still have some. Okay. Yes, Mr. Sokwane.
Thank you.
perhaps I don't know. I might be moving forward. You will what you call a rule. Chair, in line with this, I mean the question to me that you're raising as to why are you incentivizing municipalities, to me is a very big question. Now, we are informed that there are 45 municipalities that are targeted out of 283 municipalities. Now, tell me, if the three of you don't perform, you're responsible for those 283 municipalities. Now, does it mean that now the rest of those beneficiaries there in those municipalities must suffer because we don't perform? Because what we should be doing is to say, from now on, government on infrastructural work of this kind, this is how it should be done. Everybody must work according to certain what you call certain ways that promote what you call this public works thing, rather than saying, so well, if you don't perform, okay, let sleeping dogs lie, we're moving forward. The officials that work there, they have nothing to lose. Every month they receive their salary. Some of them receive bonuses, for that matter. But the ordinary people who do not work there, who stand at the corner of the streets waiting for someone, just to ask them to come and do some gardening work, we say to them, no, they must continue to suffer. We don't care about them. That is the attitude that we are to call that is the approach that we are doing here. So, I think that, Chair, there's a problem with this approach. It does not serve the interests of the ordinary person there who is suffering. In other words, we're saying those people who are not working, they must try to find ways of creating their own jobs. It cannot be their responsibility. And you say to someone who is in another municipality that is performing there, instead of saying, giving guidelines, where are your infrastructural, what you call it, programs? Then how do you ensure that in that, what you call it, you employ labor, what you call it, intensive, what you call it, methods, rather than what you call it, so saying, well, if you don't perform, to hell with you, and let your people suffer.
Let me proceed, because I wanted to come in later then. The big issue then, this thing is MIG aligned, not aligned. It says it's targeting those municipalities that have been receiving the MIG. In other words, those that have not been receiving the MIG. And that's what the big problem is. Those municipalities, therefore, are the most rural and the most needy and the most poor. And so, this is what we must then say, Zul. Let's really not ask this as a question. Let's ask National Treasury and this department to go and look at this framework again in a manner that compensates for the poor municipalities. In other words, let's go and target a municipality called Moshaweng that has not been receiving the MIG for the last 20 years. But that could have a potential to create jobs as a result of this incentive. In other words, you're giving them incentive now to say, well, you don't have revenue, etc., etc. Now we're giving you an opportunity. Now, big problem here is, they're talking Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela does not need this. But surely, Chris Hani would need it. Tata Adu would need it. Musharang would need it. Insigane too would need it. Johannesburg does not need it. Chagunyi does not. You don't even have to incentivize them for that matter. I'm saying, what we need to do is to be moving from the rural, if you like. Let's start this from the rural municipality. Ensure that this is sustainable. Then let's not rush. Let's target the rural, very rural. You're right, you've got your Tata Adu, you've got your Chris Hani, Musharung, O.R. Tambo. In the context of the 45 then, Zul. If you're saying 45, the 45 must be moving from, in fact, the most poorest
here. Let me just say the list are not 45. So that we let's give you some proper guidance now. So that you really do your work properly. We must assist your guys. The Auditor General says you have in this country 6 metros, 44 high capacity, 104 medium capacity, 129 low capacity. And surely, targeting all from those 129 low capacity, I think the intention would be better served. Rather than making a mixture of them and then make wrong comparisons. Because if you're going to compare a Tekwini with Pratatu, again, it's just not on. Tekwini has a huge budget, revenue, etc., etc. But if you would, of this 129, very low capacity, where everybody, in fact, Mr. Brown and his team that deals with the component of local government can always tell you that these municipalities are not able to retain and attract skills. And surely for us, these are municipalities that we need to be looking at. And so what we don't want you to answer, I see you seem agitated. What we want you to do is go back and look at the framework. We know what you want to say. All that you are saying between yourselves now, National Treasury, GPLG and yourselves, go and look at the framework and do that in the context of the 129 low capacity, not medium capacity, not high capacity. Why would you give Nelson Mandela, why would you give Johannesburg, why would you give, we're trying to assist these municipalities here. You know, one of the discussions, it's a pity you're not part of the discussions, you seem to be in a rush to justify this thing. If you listen to that gentleman there, the kinds of discussions we've had about making the rich richer. And we think this is the opportunity now to reach out to the poorest of the municipalities. And that's our attitude. And if you can go back, work with National Treasury and TPLG starting to identify the 45 that you talk about, if you could look at them from this list of 125, and maybe you can even increase this 45 from this 129. Very low capacity.
Chair, if I can just respond, I fully understand.
Yeah, sure.
No, I fully understand what you are saying. I think there is a difference that we need to be clear on. What the incentive is trying to do is to change behavior across different municipalities. Now, there's a simple choice municipalities have, and if I speak in layman's language,
this is what we are saying to you.
Yep.
Don't respond to me. Switch off. You can go back. You will change exactly the mindset yourselves, okay? By saying, for instance, as we move from rural municipalities, we are coming to you, medium capacity, high capacity, and metros. And the conditions would be these conditions. But you're studying here. This is a serious matter. I want you to take it serious. I want you to take it serious. You don't seem to want to take it serious, eh? No, he does not. Let me hear him first. I've seen your signal. You said, no, let's, don't worry about it. Let's go and talk about it. But let me hear what you've got to say.
Just a small point. I think what we're trying to change the behavior, every municipality has a budget. And they have a conscious choice of whether they implement things capital intensively or labor intensively. By implementing things labor intensively, there's more benefit to unemployed, you can employ more people. What the incentive is trying to do is to change the way people plan their projects, how they implement it, and how they design it. So you don't bring big yellow machines to build a road, but you employ members of the local community to employ those roads. And poor municipality by all standards, are probably the best performer on EPWP because they've consciously made up their mind to design projects and implement projects that will benefit the local community. Nkangala doesn't have any mega location, but they're probably one of the best performing municipalities when it comes to EPWP because they prioritize labor intensive methods of delivery, and that is simply what the incentive is trying to do.
Yeah, can I add to it, with your permission, Jay? No, that is precisely what it is saying. Let's say for next year, let's forget about Tswane, Joburg, because by the nature of their budget, they've got a head start. Because if you give them, they will move faster. And at the end of the day, you may, the rural ones that you want to also stimulate for rural development, you may leave behind. So what we may want to do is a start. We say, let's start with the more rural ones, the African Zoras and the others that you're talking about, and then we roll it out gradually to the rest. Let's work out the detail around it. I think it is possible.
That's what I'm saying. Bottom line is that you have, for instance, these very same municipalities, you're right, that are trying so hard. We don't have this MIG trying so hard doing these things. And really, do you still want to disadvantage them at this time when there is an opportunity now for them to at least to try and equalize? They would never equalize, really. But at least they would create some revenue. So that when you're also confronting Johannesburg, you could also say, but why are you not doing this when this municipality is able to do it? In fact, what we need to be doing for all of these other people that are not meeting the conditions of the MIG is just to hit them hard, to meet the conditions of the MIG instead of incentivizing them. Simple. Let's hold them to the conditions, but then let's try and assist these also to try and CFO, head of the delegation. What do you want to say?
Chair, I think we understand where you're coming from. And we do agree that you'll engage. No, I'm saying where you come from in terms of changing the focus to give more incentives to the 129 that you're talking about and perhaps not the your metropolitan. We thought this slide will also show that we have actually a mixture. We are not just focusing on the metropolitan, but we understand that the focus, you really want to see it being, the emphasis being on our low capacity municipalities.
What? It's so interesting to see that Tswane, Ekurhuleni, and Nelson Mandela qualified audits. And yet, let me read you the smallest municipality. It's a low capacity, unqualified. It's horrible. It's just horrible. Well, you will get the copy and read it for yourself. But I was just going to say, very tiny municipalities here in the Western Cape are doing so good. Nelson Mandela, a metro. Yeah, here it is. Steve Chwete, Mpumalanga. Financially unqualified with other matters. Karibek. Moloch. Moses Cotton. Lingsback. Can't believe this. These are all unqualified financially, like Johannesburg. And yet you go to Tswane. Horrible. Nelson Mandela. Ekurhuleni. And so, you then would want to again incentivize them. They really have all the... And I think we need to also just to start saying to them, no, enough is enough. I think from the point of view of committees must also try to assist you just to whip them a bit. But also it would be nice from where you sit at. You see, because part of what I was coming to then in terms of the provinces, which departments are you targeting there in the provinces now in terms of the provincial allocations?
In terms of the provincial allocations, I think you did answer was which sectors are we rolling out. The idea was to roll out within the infrastructure sector within year one, but then to bring in the social and the environmental sector on in year two. We are working on the criteria and how they would qualify for the incentive and how the mechanisms would work. But basically, when we look at EPWP infrastructure in province, we're essentially looking at the public works and transport budgets. So I think transport, the presentation we just had before, is potentially where we could get the most number of employment opportunities for the budgets and the projects that they have to implement.
Can I again advise you? Look, I travel rurally. For now, I think let's that provincial allocation, in my view, must be packaged in such a way that it for now goes to municipalities whilst you're looking at this. It's because I want us to do a proper audit in respect of performance of those sectors in provinces. Infrastructure in particular, if you're talking roads, for instance, and public works, because the first problem that we have, all our 9 public works departments are just messy. Even the roads departments are kind of messy. There is already a grant that they really are not using effectively. The infrastructure grant to provinces. I mean, there's huge amounts there. If you look at Limpopo, for instance, there is something called Road Agency Limpopo there. 80% of roads money is in that entity. And 20% is in the department. And so if you're dealing with EPWP issues there, incentive, how do you deal with it? Limpopo. You incentivize this agency. And already there's a problem there in terms of issues of governance. One, first thing that we worried about there is that the CEO there is not accounting to the HOT, accounts to the MEC. Secondly, salaries in the agency, the staff complements of the agency, staff complement of the agency is 40 persons, whereas the department is about 2,000 plus, and the salaries are very high. Now, in the context of the battle that we are waging of a wage bill, that must be commensurate to what people are doing. But also in the operational budget, you don't want this high salary bill. I mean, how would you then deal? I'm saying, I don't want you to rush in respect of this particular one in terms of roads. Because there's this IGP, you might want to sit back again as you roll out, as you're talking this social infrastructure, etc. How do you then start packaging it in such a manner that you incentivize therefore provinces? But for now, for me, the issue is really provinces. Because I was also worried about this. The private sector, I don't have a problem with, but then the NGOs, you have not responded to me, because I was saying to you, NGOs inherently have these tensions with municipalities. And so these things would be done ordinarily in municipalities in the context of IDPs, and so how do you ensure that the projects would be in line with United Finance? If an NGO would be allowed to build a road, EPWP road, firstly, they don't have land, and secondly, that is not in the IDP. How do we deal with that?
Can I respond to the NGO one? I think those are important points. There are essentially two programs within the non-state sector that are part of the EPWP. The first one is a community works program. This has currently been piloted by the presidency with donor funds, and the intention is to bring this onto the EPWP and budget for it. But it's about going into local areas that are particularly poverty-ridden and working with the community to identify what jobs need to be done. But clearly, the issue of alignment to IDPs are a critical one that must be sorted out and resolved within this pilot phase. But I think there it's about providing regular, predictable employment to members of the community to do things that are socially useful to the community. And they range from cutting the grass to painting the school to security, and the alignment of the IDP is critically important. The other component of the non-state sector is working with nationally based already have a financial source, and the incentive would encourage them to employ more people to do the work that they're currently doing. So that's on the non-state.
Again, I'm asking you to investigate this further. If you do this in the context of communities working with their municipality, and so in the context of an IDP, I don't have a problem. Anything, in my view, must always be in line with the IDP. Or something that had fallen off the IDP, how do you therefore pick it up and ensure that it is in the IDP, so that you don't create some things that are really parachuted by whoever because they've got funding. I mean, some NGOs or some people might not participate in the IDP discussions or reviews because they know they've got access to funding, using their own connections, etc. Because they know they would parachute whatever project. Is that really in the interest of communities? And surely would want to create some cohesion in terms of what we want to do. So please also just explore that further in terms of your own engagement. How do you work it out? Because part of the big issue is how does that budget therefore talk to the budget of the municipality? Finally. Because there must also be issues of sustainability. We don't want a situation where a project is created by an NGO and the municipality in the context of its LED says, well, that is not our project, and so let it go, it just dies a natural death. And so how do you build sustainability such that the municipality in the next financial year or financial years might also budget for the sustainability of the project? And so please, can you look at those matters?
Thanks, Chair. The challenge that we are facing now is that perhaps we were not given the full opportunity to present everything, because there is a rollout plan that was scheduled to start from the 1st of April, and there are engagements that the Minister has to do with the various committees, the mayoral committees, and the provinces. So I just need to get clarity to say, is this a directive that says we must hold on to or to the processes that are currently going on to go back and revisit this framework?
Go back. Don't go to Nelson Mandela. That's what we're saying. I mean, already you've got rural municipalities. We're saying get involved with them immediately, as in yesterday. That's the bottom line. But I think Nelson Mandela for me, really, and all the bigger municipalities, you know the data yourselves. You know the poor municipalities. Big issue for us is that most of those municipalities that you're talking about were recipients of MIG. The bigger number of municipalities that were not getting, I mean, look, Ukatlamba, you already have Alfred and Zoyu, Kusani, Sakisizo, Emalatlin, all of them. I mean, proceed. But you proceed, find ways of also enriching, but defining to the extent that we want to ensure what Mr. Brown was saying. How do we try to pick these poor so that they start competing with Nelson Mandela, if you like? But for me, really, Nelson Mandela. Already they are sitting with large. We were dealing with this transport, a conditional grant earlier, PTIS. Swale is underperforming, Nelson Mandela, and so on and so on. And those would be creating jobs already that relate directly to 2010. And those monies are not performing. I think what we're saying, and this is what really also communities out there are really saying, especially the poor, we're saying this is the opportunity for them to at least to keep some of their people in their rural areas, but also maybe to attract some jobs to rural areas for a change, not the other way around. You seem to want to say something.
Chair, it's extremely difficult for us to put this in a meaningful context. So, but we have noted the comments you've made, and I think many of the comments made would have been addressed if we would have gone through our presentation also, but we find the comments with regard to the rural urban bias obviously useful and something that we will be exploring further. Yeah, to give it a more rural slant, rather than, yeah.
No, you came here with your mind made up. That's the bottom line. But I will be watching this thing carefully. And I'll be looking forward to seeing a report of your engagement, so that that will have to inform me. And we're not really stopping you, but we are worried ourselves that... Okay. Mr. Brown, your last word, you're not on death row. CFO, your last word, you're not on death row.
No, Chair, just to thank the members for giving us this opportunity and to thank my colleagues.
I hope we have still some transport here.
So, Chair, what you're saying is that we're going to approve this division of revenue as is. I thought that you say they would come back and report, not a written report.
No, I was saying no. They must engage and engage and engage. You see, frameworks must also be talking to our problems on the ground. And this is what I'm trying to say. We cannot be rigid about this. You had a particular view about how you wanted to approach it. We are raising a particular view which we think we share. You also share. And we think in the context of that, it would be nice just to start doing that. There's no rush. If you started at Alfred Nzo, Katlamba, Chris Anisa, Kisizwa, working with them, as my colleague says, do you throw money and walk away? We're not really in a big rush here. So that we are able to see whether, for instance, the quality of jobs is also nice. I've seen, for instance, some labor-intensive roads where people have done paving with some bricks that they've made in the Free State, if you like. And so clearly for us, these are good opportunities for those areas. Roads are critical in those areas we're talking about. Well, if there is no other matter of life and death, can we will be having the next meeting on Friday here. It's 8:00 or Thursday, yeah. Because it's 5:00, you are so sharp, thanks for that. I won't be late on Friday. I'm going to sleep here in Cape Town. I'm not going to go away